Good afternoon, everybody. Thank you very much for joining us this afternoon. Thank you both today, but also throughout the year. I know a lot of you put a lot of time and effort into talking to us, giving us ideas. I very much appreciate that. Today, I'm joined by Andrew, Hannah and Ian, who I suspect are all fairly familiar with you. And that'll tell you that we're going to focus our comments today on networks and on markets. That means that we're not going to focus in my presentation on offshore, sustainable development division, or the eServe division of Ofgem. The senior partners of those three divisions aren't here today, but we're happy to take any questions that you might have on that in Q&A. And if you need more detail, which frankly, if I'm trying to answer those areas, you might need it, we can get the senior partner to give you a call, and or it can come through Alex. Now, a few weeks ago, I was asked to speak on the topic of all change in energy in the UK, and I'm going to build on that topic in today's comments. In networks, I think change has been enacted, and no clearer symbol of that is in today's Rio Stock Exchange announcement. In retail markets, change is being enacted, and in wholesale markets, change is to be enacted, with some of the detail still not clear. Now, the fusion of all three areas is very much between now and Christmas, and quite an exciting time, I think, for all of us who follow the energy and climate change world. In networks, clearly we've got the initial proposals today for the supergrid and gas distribution companies, with the final proposals following up in December. But also look out for the opening consultation document on the Rio Ed price controls, that's the local electricity distribution price controls, which will be coming your way in September. What about retail? Our retail market reform package, quite a wide-scoped and very significant package for consumers, plus our decisions on liquidity will come out in mid-October, early November. The wholesale package of the government will come out at much the same time, late October, early November, where they'll give us the details of the EMR, but also the gas generation strategy that was announced by the new Secretary of State on the 22nd of May. Now, we've got a direct feed into those documents that the government will be publishing at that time through our capacity report, and that's looking at electricity, and through our gas report, clearly looking at gas. I'm going to take those three areas one by one. So let's start with networks. Now, you've got a pack. I hope you've been able to get hold of the pack. Now, you'll be relieved to know that I'm not going to go through the press release or the detailed open letter. The figures that matter for you are on pages 8 to 14. And we'll take, I suspect, questions on those in Q&A. What I'd like to leave you with are some high-level messages that build on this page here. The first high-level message comes from the very early days when we were setting up the Rio price control, which is that capital markets involvement is seen as critical for Rio to be successful. Indeed, one of the concerns for us under the old RPI-X was that actually the capital market pressure was finding it difficult to find its way onto the management of the companies. Now, as I said in my opening comments, we're very grateful for the significant improvement that the companies have sought out from you and from others on stakeholder engagement and management. I should also repeat that today is a consultation, so again, do give us your views, even if you don't want to give them in public today or if it's too early, before we release the detailed package next week. But we also hope that you can play your part very much to bring the capital market pressures to bear onto the companies. If you've had a chance to look at the gas distribution package, a good example is that one of the companies, Northern Gas Networks, has got the top incentive award, it's got the best network innovation allowance, and it's also the leader on benchmarks. Now, that means that seven other companies are not, and quite clearly we're looking to the capital markets over the next 8 years to bring pressure to bear on those companies that aren't doing so well to make them improve. And this is where the O of Rio, the outputs that we will give you so that you can make that judgment, is going to be so important. The second key message that I wanted to touch on is that although the messages that I think we're giving today are quite positive for investment in GB, for jobs in GB, for sustainable development for security supply, Ofgem has a key responsibility to the consumer. £88 on average, more to be funded by the consumer over the next 8 years, £11 on average a year, may not seem very much on a £1,400 dual fuel bill, but it all adds up, and we take it very seriously when we put a price increase through for consumers. With an eye on that, we have been quite aggressive on reining back TOTEX. You'll have seen that we've broadly taken about 20% of TOTEX away from the companies, and we've really given them a challenge, which I would broadly call a needs case. If you want that additional money, you're going to have to make a case, and it's going to have to be good. Secondly, on the returns, clearly we're focused on ROE, which I'll come back and speak about in a minute, but if you align it with previous controls, National Grid's post-tax WACC here is 4.3, is 4.6, the GDN's is 4.3. We've sought to ensure that the returns of the company look appropriate. Now, we've therefore looked at what's important for the consumer, but we've also looked at what's important to ensure that the companies are financeable. And we've taken a critical examination of the key financial ratios, FFO net debt, PMICR, FFO interest cover, to ensure consistency with comfortable investment grade rating. And we believe that we've allowed the better companies to stretch into the low teens return on equity. So that's on the networks. I'm going to move away from there, and clearly we can come back in Q&A. We're going to jump on to page 18. Which is the retail market reform package, which, as I mentioned at the beginning, is where change is being enacted. Now, most of you will know that Ofgem and a number of the leading companies had complete meltdown at the end of 2010, early 2011, where we felt that the companies had just lost the plot, and we made it pretty clear that that's what we thought. There has been significant change since then. If we look at the change induced by the industry, they've looked in many instances at how they're operating. Headline changes that are noticeable are, for example, how they've treated doorstep selling. But more interestingly, they've looked in many instances to settle cases where they've misbehaved, effectively saying, we've done wrong, let's pay, let's move on. And this is encouraging behaviour from the companies. We know that the companies are reviewing the way they behave. So, for example, Aon has got its project reset in place. In fact, I received a letter, as some of you who might be supplied by Aon the other day, from the new chief executive saying, we've done a bad service for you and we're going to improve. Quite an interesting letter, and certainly set against what's happening in some other sectors, quite an encouraging behavioural trait. We also know that the companies are quite serious about some of the new offerings that they're making. SSE, they've reduced from 68 tariffs to 4. They've offered free energy audits. They're looking at how they improve their business altogether. I've picked out a few names, and those that I haven't picked out will be very cross with me, but that's life. The message I'm trying to give here is that the industry is starting to move to a much better place. And the key phrase there is starting to move. Ofgem, on its part, will deliver its retail market reform package in October. What's going to be in that package? Broadly, three things. First of all, the obvious stuff. Better bills, better annual statements, better information, standards of conduct, clear accreditation of switching sites, and then the less obvious stuff, but stuff that we've been talking about, trying to work towards some form of APR matrix, discounting, reviewing the future of dual fuel or not, what number of tariffs we're going to allow, and where we're going to allow them. And finally, I think the sentiment wrap around that October package will be whether we're going to leave the industry then to try and get on with it, or whether we're going to put benchmarks or time marks in the sand to say, we'll keep coming back to review what you're doing, and if you're not doing it well enough, we'll have to exert more control. I mentioned that in October, November, we'll be doing both retail market package, but also a liquidity package. Where are we on liquidity? Well, again, we've seen substantial improvements from the industry. We now have all major players performing in the N2X market. They're also involved in other markets, which we encourage them to be involved in as many markets as they can. British Gas has just joined that process. We've seen a substantial increase in day-ahead activity. And looking further out, which is clearly something that we've been most concerned about, We're looking to see whether market coupling and target markets within a European context, whether some of the relationships that some of the companies are creating with brokers, with hedge funds, to see whether there's a form of future market that they can develop with particular products is going to work. There is also, of course, an onus on Ofgem and an onus on the government here. We have to deliver a retail market reform package that provides clarity, and the government has to do the same thing on the electricity market reform package. Without that, frankly, it's very difficult to see how any supplier, small or large, is going to want to trade actively 2 or 3 years ahead because they don't know what the hell they're trading. So we're aware of these pressures, and this will all come to pass in 3 months' time when we tell you what we're going to do here. But broadly, and we've put out an open letter on liquidity today, the proposition that we gave the industry at the beginning of the year, and one of the reasons why I think they're reacting, is that if forced to, and we would do it reluctantly, we will have a regulated, mandated auction platform. Or the industry can sort this out themselves, and we may take backstop powers, but not trigger or use them unless we feel that the companies are slipping back to their bad old ways. I think a core question at this juncture, and one that we asked ourselves at an away day quite recently, is the board of Ofgem called GEMA or GERA? I.e., are we a markets authority or a regulatory authority? Well, clearly we regulate networks, but we are a markets authority, and instinctively, we would like to go through a market solution where we possibly can. If we can't, then as we've shown in the last 2 years, we have no fear in going down a different route, but it is not where our instinct would drive us. Let me come on to the third area, and I would argue, even though Ian and Hannah are sharing the platform with me today, I would argue that it's in the electricity market reform package that the biggest areas of issue for electricity and gas energy generically are sitting going forward. And I think all the eyes, quite appropriately, are on the Department of Energy and their very, very important statements that they have to make at the end of October, early November, before the bill starts to go into the House of Commons process. Now, this picture is now 2 years old, actually a little bit older than 2 years old, but we believe it's still a picture that we find comfortable talking about. Now, as you're aware, if we look at this picture here, we're about here. Indeed, National Grid's forecast from last week forecast a 2% increase in capacity margin. It's exactly what we'd have expected. And we're about to go on this ski slope here. And what do we know about the ski slope? Well, we know that lots of kit is closing. You know the Cockenses, the Didcots, the King's Norths. You can very quickly add up to 5 gigs of plant that we know is going to close in 13, 14, and plant perhaps not far behind that. We also know that there's quite a bit of plant up for sale, and this stuff is not flying off the shelves. In fact, it's finding it very hard to find a market. So when we look at that decline in the red line, and I'm using the red line here because this is slow growth out of recession, which was probably, sadly, the right one to use, what we're questioning now is the extent to which that red line might even be coming a little bit earlier. Now, why might that be the case? Because the latest numbers from the LCPD plant, that's the plant that has to close by no later than 2016, and they have hours which they can run on. They've used up 70% of their hours just about at the moment, and that's about 10% faster than the run rate you'd expect. And they're running through the summer in a more aggressive way again than you might expect. Why would they do that? Because the spark spread simply tells them to do that. The spark spread for coal, £10 to £12, spark spread for gas, virtually nothing. So this is why coal is running hard. It's running as if it's going out of fashion, and of course, that is exactly what's going to happen to it. The EUX is in the doldrums. Japan is holding LNG quite high. And even when the carbon tax is added in 2013, you've still got a premium rating of coal over gas, £8 plays three, let's say. So again, the incentive for a board to authorize £1 billion worth of spend on a CCGT is not great at the moment. So the question that the government is rightly looking at is, well, have we got this U curve that Project Discovery was talking about? Have we got an L curve, or is actually Project Discovery overdoing this and it's, you know, tapering? We don't need to worry so much. And this is absolutely the critical issue. We certainly know that this U-curve that we drew just isn't right anymore, because we based that U-curve off an assumption of one large carbon capture plant, not getting that, off one sizable nuclear plant available in 1718, you're not getting that, off a major biomass plant built by Siemens and Drax, you're not getting that, off offshore wind running at 35% load factor, it's not doing that or anywhere near it, and we're right at the bottom of the offshore range that we expected to be built. It's in the range, but right at the bottom. So all those assumptions that we were using on the U-curve, they're not there. We also know that the IED is going to bite. That's the next directive which causes this tooth effect here. And the question is, when does it bite? When does a plant like Longannet say, we've had enough, we're out? Because it's going to be really very significant. And behind all of this, for those of you, and some of you I've known for a very long time, but those of you that followed the life of the AGRs, quite clearly they're being rather well run at the moment by EDF, but certainly their life before that was pretty frightening. And our assumption through all of this is that the AGRs get life extension and run properly. So what we're looking at now then is quite a challenge, which is why I believe the Secretary of State announced in mid-May that they were going to have a gas generation strategy that they would announce in November. So far from 2 years ago, where in good faith the government said, well, we think we're needing 100 BCMs of gas today, but actually we'll go down to 76, you'd have to say we're going to go higher than 100 BCMs. And far from the expectation that, let's say, we might go from 40% gas in our power stations to 30, it now looks as if the hot money would say by 2020 we'd be at 60 to 70% needing gas in our power stations. So gas demand is becoming much more important. What of gas supply? And I think here the key issues, and you may want to pick this more up with Andrew, is about resilience, affordability, and or security. And it was quite an interesting moment when I shared a platform with Charles Hendry, the energy minister, a few weeks ago, when he said, of course, you know, energy policy is now part of foreign policy. That was a very substantial statement, I think, from the energy minister. So into all of this picture, what's Ofgem's role? Why am I even talking about it? Well, we have joint responsibility for security supply for consumers. So we do have a formal statutory role. But I see our role more positively as an advisor to government. So we're providing two sizable pieces of research out of Andrew's team. One is on gas markets. One is on capacity. And we've done the capacity work with National Grid. Crudely, one's looking at gas security supply, the other's looking at electricity security supply. And we will be, as I mentioned earlier, handing those formally to the government after the summer. We also act as an advisor with a responsibility, again coming back to our name. And therefore, the two pieces of advice that we sought to give the government, if you look at the government's package for resolving its issues, the two key pieces of advice that we've given them sit here. And incidentally, we run this one, but our pieces of advice sit here. And our advice on the capacity mechanism is, if you're going to do it, do it. Because our concern on behalf of consumers is that the longer you wait to do it, the more you force the price up. So we're looking at it from a consumer's point of view. Here, unsurprisingly, again going back to our name, is if you're going to do it, then do it through a competitive auction process, please, because that at least will bring some kind of dynamic into the marketplace or what's left of it once you've introduced that element into the electricity market reform package. Look, those are the three areas that I felt you probably want to address today. As I've said, if there are others that we've not touched on now, we'll try and take in Q&A. But I'd really rather get into the Q&A now so that we can maximise your time. I'm just going to change slots now. Okay, now, we can answer your questions formally here, informally afterwards, or privately through Alex and Harry. It's entirely up to you how you want to play today. We can end in 30 seconds, we can end in half an hour. What I would ask is that we'll go to the floor for questions. We've also got potentially some questions being called in. If you could just give us your name and institution, I don't know whether I'll answer if it's Steve Holliday of National Grid, but we might have a go. Could be quite entertaining. I'm really now putting it out to the floor. Thank you. I'll go one.
It's Mark Freshney from Credit Suisse. Alistair, you seem to be quite passionate in sending a message to the government that something needs to be done to avoid a lights-off scenario. Can I ask, how confident are you that government will get policy through quickly and also that the power generators will respond by building the necessary capacity or otherwise?
Yeah, I mean, it may sound extraordinary, but having seen a Competition Act case with National Grid last from 2004 to 2010, and some of the other enforcement cases take a very long time, I have to say that the government has acted quickly to get where it is. I mean, you may think, in your terms, it just hasn't. I mean, I used to be on your side. And you think, how can it take so long? To be where they are, to be in a position to actually make these decisions within the next 4 months, is some going in government terms, and particularly if you throw in the fact that it's a coalition. So I actually think they've moved quite well, and they've tried to steer their course, and it's such a difficult course that I think they're doing rather well. As for the power generators, fundamentally, I think the issue here is going to be whether the chief executives and or the managing directors in charge of generation at the companies can go to their boards and realistically sell what it is that the government's put on the table. Because if they can't, then those boards have got a fiduciary duty. And if the fiduciary duty means they can't build, they can't build. So I think really that the proof of the cake will be in the eating in terms of whether the government gets it right or not. But it is a very, I think we're coming up to a very big moment where the government will provide clarity on what its views are and how it intends to resolve them. Good to go Ian here and Robin.
Hi, it's Ian Turner from Exane. Can I just ask what a competitive market in energy retail looks like? If it's a market where everyone stops doing doorstep selling, is that a competitive market or a non-competitive market?
I think it's a really good question. What does success look like? And that would be a key question, I think, if we went to a Competition Commission inquiry when we release our retail market package. And, of course, we might. I think what we're really focused on, you probably gathered that from the list that I gave you, what we're really focused on is high-quality information provision, ensuring that the customer understands what it is that they are or aren't getting, and that they feel empowered to make a choice. Now, whether they make that choice is ultimately up to them. And I think, to put it crudely, 6 or 7 years ago, the level of switching would be the key determinant by which we looked at this. I think we're more holistic now. And that's why I say that third element of the package, which my board might want to make almost a philosophical statement about in October, could be quite important, even though we might all be looking at the actual elements. I think it might be the packaging that could be quite important. Andrew, do you want to pick
up? Yeah, the only thing I would add to that is that what we are looking for is a market that provides an effective competitive constraint on the companies, because that's how you drive improvements in efficiency, improvements in customer service and innovation. And so if you haven't got that, then I think there's a concern about whether consumers in general get the value for money that they should get. So we are looking to increase the level of consumer engagement, partly to make sure that individual consumers get a good deal, but also to make sure that competitive constraint exists as well.
I'm going to come down. No, we're just go there and there.
It's Bobby Chatter from Morgan Stanley. Two questions about the documents you've released today. The first is, Alistair, in your comments you alluded to, good companies getting into the low teens ROEs. Can you add anything to that about what the drivers to get there might be? It's obviously a long way from the ROEs in your documents. And then secondly, in terms of the CapEx reductions in transmission, there isn't a huge amount of detail in these yet. I appreciate we'll get more in a couple of weeks, but would you classify most of those as reductions in unit cost, or have you made changes to the scope of the CapEx programs that companies have put to you? Thanks.
Yeah, good questions. And without me wanting to hog all the limelight, I'm going to ask Hannah to answer the ROE, and I'm going to ask Ian to answer the CapEx.
Okay, so on the ROE side, we've set out the indicative ranges. The companies can outperform the baseline ROE by either improving cost efficiency, and they're very strong sharing factors both in the gas distribution and in the transmission price controls, so the companies will keep a large proportion of any cost outperformance on that side. There are also financial incentives attached to the output mechanisms. So a company that does better than the baseline on the output incentives will again see their actual return on equity be higher than the baseline. So if you stack those up, then you, in nominal terms, you get into the low teens that Alice has been talking about.
Moving on to CapEx.
Yes, I mean, I think there's there's slightly differing stories here on National Grid electricity transmission and National Grid gas. On National Grid electricity transmission, most of the expenditure that's been taken out is relating to CapEx unit cost efficiencies. That's been done through looking at what was achieved through the last control period, looking at our consultants' reports, and indeed looking at the ScotCo proposals that were published earlier in the year. There is some other expenditure that has gone, some OPEX efficiency as well, and also some expenditure that it relates to outputs you would expect in effectively RIIO-T2 that we would look to actually pay for in RIIO-T2. On the National Grid gas side, on the transmission side, it is a slightly different story with a mix of volumes and unit costs coming out. Some of the volumes relating to effectively what incremental CapEx, what demand-led CapEx is likely to come over the control period, but also a fair amount of unit costs in there as well. And there are some numbers in our annex to our document that we published today that can give a bit more information on that.
I guess you're going to want more detail and a more detailed conversation. We're happy to have it with you when the big package comes out next week. Thank you.
It's Dominic Nash from Liberum Capital, sort of staying on RIIO. Sort of two questions here. Firstly, on inflation expectations, can you give us sort of more colour as to what your inflation expectations are going out to come up with your calculations? And then associated with that, the returns that you provided, at face value, 6.77% post-tax real is slightly lower than previous reviews. But with the risk-free at -1%, is there, and the equity risk premium at an all-time high between what you're giving and what the markets are paying, is there a risk that you'll lower returns going into the final determination?
I'll take the one about lowering returns as we go to the final determination. Hannah, do you want to answer inflation and the risk-free ranges?
Yeah, so on inflation, we have said that the price control will be indexed to RPI. The numbers that are provided in the document today are actually in real prices. So the RAV values, for example, are in 9-10 prices. So there is no assumption in there about inflation explicitly.
Okay, and following on from that, so if inflation outturns materially higher or materially lower than sort of the base case assumption that you should have in your numbers, have you got a mechanism that self-corrects to so they can come back and ask for a rate recase, or do you have a clawback?
So the price control automatically gets updated for RPI every year, and that automatically feeds through the price control.
And just to answer your question on initial proposals versus final proposals, I mean, from the board's proposition, we're feeling much more confident now than, well, maybe foolish, but we are feeling much more confident now than we have done under the RPI minus X regime. We've had two rounds of detailed business plans. We've had rounds of conversations and negotiations with the companies. It may be that we have to make changes between now and December. It may be that we've made an accounting mistake or something has arisen that we hadn't taken properly on board. But by and large, one of the reasons that we've gone for spot announcements today is that we want to provide a degree of clarity as to where our thinking is, rather than to give you that range, which then is a bit of a bun fight between now and December. Because we go through these very detailed rounds now and do so much early on, you know, a legitimate question from my board to a company that says, ah, but you missed, is, well, why the hell wasn't it in business plan round one or two? And the company will have to have a very good answer for that.
Hi, hi, it's Martin Brough from Deutsche Bank. Given the controversy elsewhere in financial markets about indices of interest rates, etc., how confident are you that using a general corporate cost of debt index is a robust basis for tracking what utility finance costs might be? You know, there's obviously, it used to be sort of said that interest costs were sort of commoditized by credit rating, but that clearly isn't the case now. There's a huge range within particular credit ratings, which may or may not stay going forward. So given the quite large weights you're placing on the debt element of this, how confident are you that is a robust measure to base the allowed cost of debt on?
It's a really great question. I think my first answer, it isn't meant to sound a flighty answer, but I think it's true. It's a lot better than the board of Ofgem meeting once every 5 or 8 years to give a subjective view from a majority of board who perhaps it's not a natural port of call for them. So I think it's better than what we had. I'm interested to know if there are those in the room who think that this is really badly inappropriate, perhaps particularly in the light of some other issues going on in the market. And we are out to consultation. I mean, we don't close our ears to debates or arguments that may have a very strong value if the market is changing. But I certainly think set against a subjective rate, it's an improvement. It certainly provides clarity. Thank you. At the back of the hall. Thank you.
A question to Ian and Hannah on the gearing assumptions used in the price controls. They're certainly higher than those used in, you know, recent price controls elsewhere, and also higher than those used for the Scottish transmission owners. I was just wondering, what is your justification for using sort of like 60 to 65% gearing, which, let's face it, is way above what I think many shareholders in companies, listed companies, find is acceptable right now?
Should we go Ian first, then Hannah?
Yeah, we always said in our RIIO documents that we were going to look at cash flow risk in order to set the financial parameters. In the case of National Grid Electricity Transmission, when we look at things like the CapEx to RAV investment prospects, we felt very much that the cost of equity being the same as the ScotCos was right. But then when we looked at, in effect, the cash flow risk that was left on the company, we felt that actually that was lower, and therefore we raised the gearing accordingly. And we went through a similar process actually for NGGT and, dare I say, for the GDNs as well.
I think the story is exactly the same with gas distribution. So when you look at the cash flow risk that the GDNs face, it is less than the transmission companies, both on the electricity side in particular, but also the gas side, and that's why the notional gearing is higher for the GDNs than it is for the transmission companies.
Thank you.
That's Jamie Tunnicliffe from Redburn. Two questions. One on sort of credit ratios for the announcements today on RIIO. Can you just explain a little bit more about your testing of those and sort of maybe which ones, if any, you've placed a little bit more importance on than the others? I presume those are done in nominal terms, so inflation would have to be taken into account for those, so maybe just give us some insight what inflation you've assumed to test those credit ratios. And then secondly, just on RMR, if you end up putting in those reforms and that leads to better information for customers, as you say, sort of making more meaningful decisions, But as a result of that, profitability of the industry improves. Is that a problem for you?
Both good questions, and therefore I'm not going to answer them. Hannah, do you want to start the first one? And Andrew, do you want to do RMR?
Yeah, on the credit ratio point, we will publish the model with initial proposals at the back end of this month, and that will give you all the data that you need to calculate the ratios specifically. But if I can just answer your question at a sort of high level, we look at all three of the rating agencies at how they monitor investment grade. We take all of those into account. We monitor or we track a number of ratios: asset price control, FFO interest cover, adjusted FFO interest cover, RAV gearing, FFO net debt, and RCF investments. Of those, we put more weight on the adjusted FFO interest cover and the RAV gearing, but we also take into account the other factors that the rating agencies look at, for example, the state of regulatory regime, the financial backdrop, the company's ownership structure, and so on. And we put all of that together to build up a picture to see if the company would achieve investment-grade credit metrics over the period.
Jamie, could you please repeat the second question? Sorry.
Sure. Well, there was a little follow-up on the first one, which was just say what inflation went into testing those.
So you'll see that in the model.
Okay.
But we do test it against, we don't try and predict inflation, so we test it against a range.
Okay. And Ian, the question was, after you've put in place these, sorry, Andrew, after we've put in place the RMR reforms, which you say about giving people better information, they're making more meaningful choices, if the profitability of the retail industry improves after that, is that a problem?
Well, I think it's first to say that the profitability of the industry is just one of many measures that we look at for the competitive intensity of the industry. We don't regulate profits. We've been very careful not to set expectations about what a reasonable level of profitability should be. We look at a wide range of measures of competitiveness in the industry. Some of the pricing dynamics, for example, that we analysed in the original RMR report, for example, are important. Some of the measures around customer service, switching behaviour, a whole wide range of activities and measures. So what we're really interested in is, are customers making information with good information is there indications that the level of competition in the market is increasing? So I'm slightly dodging your bullet, but I think that's a genuine answer that we don't actually see this as a quasi profit regulation process.
Okay. Now I'm going to take one more from the hall. It doesn't mean that we can't have any more from the hall, but then I'm just going to look to see if there's any questions coming on the line. So we take question here, and then I'm just going to look into that glass box there to see if there's anybody wants to ask.
Thank you. Hi, Mark Walters, JP Morgan. Do you think in the environment that we're looking for long-term, stable capital structures, that the use of a 10-year trailing average leads to short-termism in corporates' refinancing strategies and linked to the cost of debt that we're using here?
I think it's a good question. I think a lot of the points that Alistair made in relation to the other question on cost of debt apply here, but we also tested when we developed the index how much difference it would make to use a longer-term trading average. We looked at 20-year average, for example. And actually, it doesn't make a huge amount of difference. There's also a data availability issue. So I think for partly practical reasons, we went for the 10-year, but we convinced ourselves that it didn't make a huge difference in terms of the level.
Have we got any questions on the lines? No, that's great. I think there was one towards the back of the room. Thank you.
Richard Alderman, Macquarie. In the past, the water regulator, I'm thinking of Ian Byatt, made specific comments about the assumptions the regulation process made about distribution of dividends in the past, not in the future. Clearly, that's not your role. Have you made any assumptions here? Because clearly, at the corporate level, National Grid has been paying out substantially above inflation, and I guess from the subsidiary company up to the holding company, the same.
I mean, it wouldn't surprise you to hear me lean back onto my cash flow ratio analysis, and we come at this from the investment grade proposition. it really is up to the company to work out their own dividend policy. Thank you.
Sorry, Martin Bruff again from Deutsche. Your RIIO reforms, I mean, at some point in the future, one of the controls might be tested at the Competition Commission or whatever it's called, post-OFT CMA. Merger. And if the Competition Commission takes a different approach in terms of looking at public interest issues, you know, let's say it just decides, look, a whack on a RAB is better than splitting equity and debt, or we have a different approach to financeability or other forms of incentive. Today, as a, effectively the Court of Appeal, will that cause you to revisit some of the principles you're using going forward, or will you just say, well, that was in a one-off from the CC and we still think our approach is best?
I mean, I think it would depend on what the issue was, but we take advice that the CC or the CMA, as I think it will be, very seriously, and if somebody wants to test RIIO, actually now's the time to do it, and we probably all benefit from it. So I'm not saying you should do it. All I'm saying is we're not frightened of this going to a CC because we're not frightened about having the best result. The only reason you'd be frightened about going to a CC is if you're frightened about somebody saying that isn't quite the right way of doing something, which we're not. We want to have the best result. So if we haven't quite got that and the CC gave it to us, then great. Thank you.
Lakis Athanasiou, two questions. One on liquidity. Liquidity is a good thing in a market, but what is your primary driver behind increasing it? Is it about satisfying the complaints by small suppliers? Or is it about a reference price for future CFDs? I mean, the reason I ask is that, you know, I think small suppliers in this kind of market are just, you know, they're going to be uncompetitive, whatever liquidity is. And if they still keep whinging afterwards, you know, would that keep you pushing away at liquidity? The second question is on capacity mechanism. I'm not sure you may want to answer this, but I do get a sense that government is seriously considering some kind of two-tier market, one for existing, one for new. So new get long-term high prices, existing get low short-term prices. If that were to happen, would you have any strong views on that one way or the other?
You're not going to like the answer. I get into enormous trouble if I try to answer the second question, which I'd like to. So let's wait and see what they do, because then perhaps is the time for us to have that kind of conversation. Might be. That's for the government to resolve. Let's take liquidity. Andrew.
Yeah, we set out three criteria for how liquidity work. One was a liquid short-term market. The second was products and access to products that met the needs of small suppliers to address what we believed was one of the potential barriers to entry for small suppliers in the market. And the third was effective reference prices along the curve. And I think we've set out already that we feel that the companies have come quite close to meeting that first objective of short-term liquidity. There are some positive moves regarding the provision of liquidity for small suppliers, a number of positive initiatives, and you know, evidence of improved attitude and willingness to be responsive to the needs of small suppliers. On the third one, I think there's still some way to go, and indeed partly potentially because of the uncertainty created by EMR and other policy changes, I think we're potentially seeing some declines in longer-term liquidity. So I think we're looking at meeting those three objectives, and they are all important in different ways to different aspects of the market. I'm not going to get in trouble by answering the capacity mechanism question. It's fair to say that the legislation does distinguish between new and existing plant, but that doesn't necessarily mean there's going to be a different price for them. But clearly it shows that government's keeping his options open on that.
Okay. I think one more there. We've got two more.
Evan Reed from JP Morgan. Two questions. Firstly, on gas security of supply, you talked quite a lot about it, and there's quite a lot in the slides about it. Do you think there are sufficient incentives for new gas storage at the moment? And then the second question is around uncertainty with regard to gas. So once again, you sort of laid out this view of the world where we're going to need a lot more gas and there's a lot more uncertainty about it. But at the same time, you've obviously cut CapEx for gas transmission. So sort of how do those things square? And do you think there's a chance that there might be more CapEx at some point in the future?
Let's take the questions. It was interesting. I forget how you exactly phrased it, but you said, are the incentives appropriate? I'm not entirely sure there are any incentives there for gas storage at the moment. And so I suppose the key political question would be whether they wanted to play, and they've got a handful of cards, whether they want to play a card in the storage route. Now, is that basically market-based storage with a bit of a pep up from the consumer? Is it strategic storage? Don't know. These are decisions that the government has to take. This is high policy. This is big stuff. With regard to, and incidentally, I hope that that kind of thing is going to be addressed by the government in late October, early November. With regard to gas transmission, that is a very legitimate question to ask us. So, Ian, do you want to take that?
Yeah, sure. I mean, more detail will be coming out in a couple of weeks on this, but it's fair to say that we are going to be allowing some funding to increase the flexibility of the network, and also we're not closing the door on additional funds, but that's something that we feel very much needs to be justified, and there needs to be a needs case for it, and if it can be justified, then there will be more expenditure for that being allowed.
And those projects are listed, so you'll be able to see what they are. One at the back of the hall. Thank you.
Yes, hi, it's Andrew Mulder at Credit Sites. Hannah, you talked about the lower cash flow risk allowing higher gearing. Excuse me. And I just wonder, how do you quantify low cash flow risk? What exactly do you mean by that? And sort of where's the threshold for deciding that a company has this nebulous low cash flow risk? Thank you.
Okay. Excuse me. You'll see this when the document gets published at the end of the month, but we look at return on regulated equity, and we basically look at how much cash flow the risk the company is holding given the uncertainty mechanisms we put in place. So, for example, the sharing factor for gas distribution companies is between 60 and 65%, depending where they are in efficiency range. So they do take quite a lot of the cash flow risk on their general cost base for delivery of their sort of baseline program. But then in other areas, they have a lot of protection against price risk, so we'd take that out. So we build up a picture, basically using a Monte Carlo simulation, and the cash flow risk they can take on each part of the control to build up that stat chart. So we look at the cash flow risk on its asset base, basically.
Okay, there's a question for me again.
It's a question about sort of funding, really. There's been a fair bit of discussion over the last year or so about a sort of notional co-investment model where infrastructure or pension fund partners might choose to invest directly alongside a company like National Grid or indeed any of the others. Do you have any particular thoughts on that? Would you be open to the idea of individual assets almost, or projects having their own RAV within the greater RAV, or do you feel it's something that is of no concern to Ofgem and it's up to the company to try and set, or any company, to set that up if they want to?
It's a really interesting question. And the first time I came across this was actually talking to MidAmerican, who own Northern Power Networks. Because in America, they do this with some of their network companies, where they have some co-investment on some of the assets. By and large, as you know, Ofgem doesn't get into a discussion of how a National Grid should structure its group capital structure. We do our price control on the ring-fenced business in front of us. So I'm looking at Hannah nervously because she might just kick me under the table, or Ian, but I mean, this seems to me like just the kind of area where Ofgem typically doesn't go, because the company has to be responsible for its own corporate structures, and it builds that around the regulatory regime that we set.
No,
I'm not being kicked.
No.
It's the right answer. There we are. That's good. Thank you.
Lakis Athanasiou. Onshore transmission competition, should we be taking that at all seriously, or was that just a throwaway set of remarks you did last year? Or, you know, is it something serious, or is it just something you wanted to put in to ginger things up a bit?
So is this competition on the OFTA?
Onshore, not offshore.
Sorry, onshore. Well, it's sitting there as part of the original Rio package. I think there were five criteria that had to be met before we would put a certain asset out to competitive tender. So I don't know if you picked that up, but...
Yeah, I mean, it's still very much a prospect, but what we've decided is that we are looking in the round at the moment about integrated planning and regulation of transmission. So we're looking at, in effect, how to integrate more across the onshore, cross-border and offshore regime. And it seemed natural to look at that first and then to move on to develop the criteria that can work on. But we were very clear, and we in the ScotCo proposals, and we will be very clear that it is still a prospect that may well happen during the Rio T1 period.
It's worth going back and having a look at the original Rio package, because the criteria are quite onerous. So for something to be taken away from hydroelectric or from National Grid, you've got to get over those hurdles, and as I say, they're quite substantial hurdles. Thank you.
Very much, HBC. I'm just going back to your cost of debt here, and I'm just wondering what, in terms of banking restrictions, new capital restrictions, you're taking into consideration, or are you just simply thinking about your iBox trailing average index? Is that a part of your thoughts on financeability, changing dynamics in bank credits? And
yeah, it's just a straight trailing average in the iBox, so you can look at straight off the iBox system.
There's no thoughts about the changing dynamics of bank debt in this in.
The one change we made was for hydroelectric, where they've got their own tailored index, where the weighting of that index, rather than being a simple average, is weighted according to its expected capex spend. But that's the only change we've made, other than having the straight trailing average.
Okay, just anybody coming in on the calls? No? That's... Great. Well, look, thank you all very much for coming out today. As I say, if there's anything that you'd like to pick up either immediately now or give us a call, we'll do our very best to handle that. Thanks a lot.